food producers everywhere are having to rethink what it takes to get their products from the field to your kitchen table. Author Michael Pollan is here to help us track the way two common foods, bananas and beef, make that journey. Michael Pollan's at the University of California, Berkeley right now. Okay, Michael, we got a bunch of bananas. They're still green, dangling from a tree someplace in Central America. What's it going to take to get them to my lunch bag?
Well, a boat. I mean, I think that's the key thing. Bananas are one of those foods that arrives, since it can be picked green and shipped, it comes usually from Central America these days and arrives by boat, which, as it turns out, is a pretty efficient way to move food around the world compared to, say, a diesel truck, with the result that, you know, surprisingly enough, the carbon footprint of those bananas may be lighter than the carbon footprint of, let's say, a bunch of strawberries that have been shipped to you across the country.
Okay, so, well, if the bananas are coming from Central America, let's say they come by boat, they would land where and then have to travel by what means to get to Sault Ste. Marie,
yeah,
Michigan?
Well, they would first travel by ship, and they would be unloaded either somewhere in the American South or probably the American East Coast, let us say New Jersey. And then they would take a trip by truck, diesel truck, and that's where the bulk of the carbon emissions would come, is in that truck ride.
And how about the example of beef? Now, we know that no two cows are alike, and we can split it down into, say, feedlot beef being fattened up someplace maybe in the American Midwest, and grass-fed cows, which may be munching on the pampas in Argentina.
Yeah, or they may be munching on the grass in the Hudson Valley, say, and you live in New York. I mean, it really depends where they're coming from. The key point here, I think, is we get a little too hung up on mode of transportation. And, you know, there's been a lot of confusion sowed about this whole idea of carbon footprint and food. But at one level, it's kind of simple. And the beef example, I think, helps you understand it. You can either be eating from a food chain that is based on solar energy, or you can be eating from a food chain that is heavily based on fossil fuel energy. And that's really the key distinction. So that if you are eating beef that has been raised on grass, wherever it's raised, let's leave the transportation issue aside, that is a solar-based food chain. The sun feeds the grass, and the grass feeds the ruminant. It's a ruminant because it can digest grass, and the ruminant feeds us. So by and large, that is, you're getting your calories of energy from the sun, and therefore the carbon footprint is fairly light. Now, it is true that the cow is belching methane, so there is some imprint that way. But compare that to feedlot beef, which is what most of us eat in this country most of the time. That beef is grown, by and large, with a diet dominated by corn. You look at how the corn is grown, and lo and behold, it's all fossil fuel.
I wonder, when we look overseas, especially at what's happening, and in parts of this country as well, with people who don't have enough food, but certainly overseas, people who are not able to even have one good meal a day in certain parts of the world, is it a luxury for us to be thinking about food miles and what's going to leave less of a carbon imprint?
Well, I don't think it's a luxury, because the problem is a worldwide problem. I mean, how we feed those hungry people today, do we just ramp up production with more chemical agriculture so we have more surpluses so we can dump more grain overseas? Or do we teach people and give them the good seeds and give them the good sources of fertility so that many places in the world can grow their own food and be less dependent on the shocks to the global market? And the sooner we can get our food system, disentangle our food economy from our energy economy, the better we will be, and the less hunger we will see.
Just one more question. We heard in Jeb Sharp's piece about how concerned farmers are about what's going to be happening to them. Who are the winners as food prices rise?
Well, the winners are people who handle grain, companies like ADM and Cargill, the middlemen, just like the oil companies. Even though their raw material costs are going up, they are making tremendous profits, and some of them just reported their profits today, and they're eye-popping. So there are winners, and there will be farmers who are winners. It's really good times in the Farm Belt. If you're selling grain, and you're not in a part of the country stricken by drought, you're having one of the best years you've had in 30 years. So make no mistake, there are winners. And there may be winners overseas as well. You know, there may be small peasant farms that are doing better today because there is such a vibrant market for grain, both locally and internationally. So there are always winners.
Michael Pollan's most recent book is In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. He joins us from Berkeley, California. Michael, thanks.
Thank you.